The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, coming to you live from Edstone, England, right here on the beautiful campus of Armstrong College. And, of course, our regional office is situated here as well. Speaking of the college, yesterday afternoon we had our final Armstrong Club event of the year, graduating two members of the club, so congratulations to those two who are now moving on. In fact, they're moving back to Edmond, Justin and Zach, and will be working at the headquarters campus. The theme this year in the Spokesman Club has been Winston Churchill, his leadership, and so there were quite a few examples in the table topics yesterday and also the speeches and the closing comments that just brought to mind some of the things I was reading I guess last fall from William Manchester's book on Winston Churchill. I didn't quite finish it. I set it aside for some other things. So it really got me excited to get back to that book and to finish it up. So much about that man that's worth studying into. And hopefully, I don't know if I'll have time really to get into much of a Bible study today, but with this being graduation week here for Armstrong College, I'll hopefully be able to spend some time on knowledge and wisdom and understanding and just true education in general, something that, of course, we think about in particular at this time of year as we see another crop of students go through the program here at Armstrong College. Well, as for the news, we have a lot to get into today, some excellent pieces, again, on Germany and Europe. We'll update you on the skyrocketing murder rates in the city of Baltimore. And, of course, we'll remind you as well of the hysteria surrounding Donald Trump's firing of James Comey and so many media outlets over the weekend sounding the alarm at just how dangerous this administration is.
I think this is a potentially more dangerous situation than Watergate, and we're at a very dangerous moment.
Donald Trump, in much of his rhetoric and many of his actions, poses a danger to American democracy.
Yes, that is a big step toward a more authoritarian American system. That had they been asked about it in advance, they would have said, no, that's the way to a police state. If this works, the system, when it's done, will be a permanently different political system, not just because of the president, but because of his support in Congress. And one of the most important institutions in the country will be broken.
5 days now since the firing of James Comey, and this is the low point in Donald Trump's young presidency. It also feels, to some in the media, like a tipping point.
Have we crossed a line here?
Well, I will just say that the developments of the past week, very bothersome, very disturbing to me. I think in many ways our institutions are under assault, both. And I think as well our institutions are under assault internally.
Internally from the president?
Exactly.
Donald Trump has tried to put himself above the law. And that's not how it works in America.
Trump is ignoring what presumably would be obvious counsel from anyone who knows what he's doing.
What the president has tried to do, make no mistake, is to impede these legitimate investigations. And as he said, I fired Comey because of this Russia thing. It is a dangerous, dangerous moment.
A dangerous moment in America, a real low point. We've reached a tipping point, the media tell us. All the institutions being under assault. One comment, well, actually, there were more than one. But we included one in that particular montage. An individual saying that we're now in a police state, living in a police state because of this presidency that's not even 4 months old. He's been in office less than 4 months. Barack Obama, on the other hand, he's got an 8-year track record. Barack Obama targeted American citizens with drone strikes. He took out American citizens abroad with drone strikes. They had no day in court, no due process. They were gone at the decision of Donald Trump's predecessor. This is from a report on January the 10th, earlier this year, from Vox. It says, even more chilling from a constitutional perspective is that the Obama administration has, with little or no complaint from the American people or the other two branches of government, or we could add to this, the major media. Little or no complaint. It says he deliberately targeted and killed U.S. citizens in drone strikes without those individuals ever having been given their constitutional right to due process of law. This Vox piece goes on and says the Obama administration justifies this by arguing. This is while he's still in office. This was in early January, before the inauguration. The Obama administration justifies this by arguing that, quote, when an American has made the decision to affiliate himself with Al-Qaeda and target fellow Americans, that there is a legal justification for us to try to stop them from carrying out plots. And then the piece says here, though Obama acknowledges that U.S. citizens are subject to due process under the Constitution, his Attorney General, Eric Holder, has argued that due process and judicial process are not one and the same, particularly when it comes to national security. Apparently, the administration believes that its own internal processes for determining if a U.S. citizen can be killed in a drone strike are sufficient enough to count as giving someone due process. Its own internal processes. In other words, if the administration decides that so-and-so needs to be killed, then that's enough. That's enough authority. Never mind the other two branches of government. Never mind what the American people say. Never mind what the news media might say. Of course, the news media didn't say much. They went silent. They gave him a pass for targeting American citizens abroad. Here at home, I mean, he went after Tea Party and conservative groups. All kinds of reports from 2013. These conservative groups that were speaking up. One article here from Forbes. It says here, in August 2010, the IRS distributed a BOLO, that's a Be On the Lookout list, for Tea Party organizations applying for tax-exempt status. In October 2010, Forbes writes, IRS exempt organization chief Lois Lerner met with the DOJ about prosecuting conservative groups. So the IRS went after conservative groups, and it put out a Be On the Lookout list for Tea Party organizations, targeting conservative groups at home, targeting Americans, literally, abroad. And then you know all about, if you've listened to this program anyway, or read America Under Attack, or Great Again, or visited thetrumpet.com over the years, you know all about the previous administration bragging about bypassing Congress. You know, I've got a pen and a phone, and I'll do what I need to do through executive actions. I'll direct my cabinet, as he said, to come up with executive actions to implement my policies. In September of 2012, this is about, halfway through President Obama's 8 years, a panel of experts presented a list to the House Judiciary Committee of how President Obama is exceeding his constitutional constraints. And this is how Human Events summarized the findings. As President Barack Obama has made a habit of bypassing or ignoring constitutional limitations on his power. He made that his habit for 8 years. We're talking about an 8-year track record. And the habit was to bypass or to ignore constitutional limitations on his power. What about all of the spying scandals during those 8 years? spying on France. We learned in January 2013 that the NSA had spied on 70 million phone calls in France. Germany, of course, that made some news in October of 2013. Edward Snowden revealing that the NSA had been tapping Angela Merkel's phone, the German chancellor's phone. And then the spying on Israel and even interfering in Israel's elections. We learned about that a couple of years ago, December 2015. The Wall Street Journal. Listen to what the Wall Street Journal said. This is from December 2015. So this would be, what, about a year and a half ago. The National Security Agency's targeting of Israeli leaders and officials also swept up the contents of some of their private conversations with U.S. lawmakers and American Jewish groups. So it wasn't just spying on Israel. It's kind of like the unmasking with, oh, it just so happens all these Trump supporters or Trump officials were on the other end of this conversation with some Russian official. Here was another situation where you had Israelis, their phones being tapped, and including private conversations with U.S. lawmakers, spying on members of Congress, American citizens. But of course, you can just say, well, we did unmask a few things, but we kept all of that confidential. Listen to this from the Wall Street Journal. White House officials believed the intercepted information could be valuable to counter Mr. Netanyahu's campaign. That's his campaign against the nuclear arms agreement with Iran. You remember that? You remember how much Netanyahu was against that and how he came over here and spoke before Congress? Or by here, I mean the United States. He spoke in the United States. He spoke before Congress to warn them and to tell them this is a bad deal. Well, they thought, the White House, the Obama administration, they thought by intercepting this information that they could then counter what Netanyahu was saying. It says here they also recognized that asking for it was politically risky. So, here's how they went about it. Wary of the paper trail, stemming from a request, the White House let the NSA decide what to share and what to withhold. Official said. We didn't say do it, a senior official said. We didn't say don't do it. So they just kind of turned a blind eye to it, but gave them a nod and a wink. Go ahead and get the information. It'll come in handy. Now this is what the Wall Street Journal reported just 2 years after President Obama had this to say in a speech before the NSA. This is clip 2.
And the leaders of our close friends and allies deserve to know that if I want to know what they think about an issue, I'll pick up the phone and call them rather than turning to surveillance.
Right. I won't spy on our friends like Israel and France and Germany. I'll pick up the phone, he said, as he was tapping into Angela Merkel's phone, as he was tapping into the phones of many Israeli officials. Same with France. This Wall Street Journal piece says, who's going to look at that box and say, no, I don't want to know what world leaders are saying, a former Obama administration official said. I mean, if we have the option to know what they're saying ahead of the actual speech or when they actually make the visit to the United States or to wherever, we're not going to turn that down. I mean, the NSA is collecting all kinds of information. This is valuable information, said the Obama administration. Of course, it tapped into all kinds of phones in the United States as well. 2012, the report of those 20 AP reporters tapped, their phones had been tapped. They went after the Fox News reporter, James Rosen. We've gone through some of this before, I know. Cheryl Atkinson in 2014. Her laptop was, she has all these reports about just the abuses of power in the Obama administration. So they went after her. And according to the New York Post, a source checked her laptop and found that the spyware that was there was, quote, proprietary to a government agency. Some kind of government agency was tapping into her phone and computer. In America Under Attack, we told you about the NSA's data warehouse in Utah. And you had all of these nine major internet companies just handing over all kinds of information to the NSA. Information on average Americans, phone records, emails, pictures, documents. And of course, these companies, Microsoft, Yahoo, Google, Facebook, YouTube, AOL, Skype, Apple, they all excused it by saying, well, we were kind of forced to do it. I mean, the government needed the information, so we turned it all over. And great again. This is from pages 6 and 7. We quote William Benny, a 32-year veteran of the NSA turned whistleblower. And he asked where all of this was leading, this massive collection of data, this massive system of surveillance. And we quote him in the booklet saying, it's really a turnkey situation where it can be turned quickly and become a totalitarian state pretty quickly. The capacities to do that is being set up. And my father in the booklet talks about how chilling that statement from Benny is. He said, look at the potential power the government already has. Look at the potential power. Look at the power the Obama administration was amassing during the course of 8 years. We have an 8-year track record. The Bible says to judge by fruits. You can look back over those 8 years and see what was happening in 2009, in 2011, 2012, 13. The Wall Street Journal report from 2015, all the spying. And of course, we've heard in recent months about all of the unmasking. Susan Rice, all those requests that she made for U.S. persons to be identified. U.S. individuals connected to the Donald Trump transition and campaign. Dozens and dozens and dozens of requests, hundreds in some cases. The New York Times, this is from February 14th, earlier this year. Phone records and intercepted calls show that members of Donald J. Trump's 2016 presidential campaign and other Trump associates had repeated contacts with senior Russian intelligence officials in the year before the election, according to four current and former American officials. Now, this was something that the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and, well, more the Washington Post, I meant to say. This is something that they were reporting in January, in February, in March, and reporting it proudly. I mean, this we are grateful that the Obama administration, using these authoritarian tactics, even in the weeks before it left office, we sure are thankful they were watching Trump. They were watching Trump officials. And then, of course, there were some conservative voices that started to push back hard on this, saying, well, hang on a second. What do you mean you were watching U.S. citizens? Well, I mean, it was unmasking. I mean, we weren't spying on them specifically. It was more Russian officials. And the backtracking started and so on. But you put all of these reports together, and it's pretty condemning. From March 1st, New York Times, it says, in the Obama administration's last days, some White House officials scrambled to spread information about Russian efforts to undermine the presidential election and about possible contacts between associates of President-elect Donald J. Trump and Russians across the government. Former American officials say they had two aims: to ensure that such meddling isn't duplicated in future American or European elections, and to leave a clear trail of intelligence for government investigators. And so they expanded the government's powers even a week or a week and a half before President Trump took office, so that all of this information, and of course, still, James Clapper and everyone else has come forward and said there's no evidence of any kind of collusion. So set that aside and look at the government and what it was doing. All of the information gathering on all of these people associated with the campaign and the transition team of Donald Trump. It says, as Inauguration Day approached, Obama White House officials grew convinced that the intelligence was damning and that they needed to ensure that as many people as possible inside the government could see it, even if people without security clearances could not. So they just changed the rules. And that way they could spread it all over the place. And of course, inevitably, you have all of these leaks that have come as a result of this. As a result of this administration, that, as my father says in Great Again, that while it was undermining America's position and power abroad, it was amassing power at home. This great federal Leviathan meddling in everything, race, Tea Party groups, using the IRS, using the military, using drone strikes. The White House, I mean, not the government in the sense of the three branches, the Obama administration. And my father said in America Under Attack, one of our most popular booklets that we've produced in the last few years, he said, this is quickly moving us toward rule by a dictatorship or a tyranny. Here again, you want to talk about a police state. You want to talk about tyranny. Donald Trump's not even been in there for four months. Now the jury's still out on him. I mean, what will we be able to look back and say in 4 years or 8 years from now? But what can we say without question about the past 8 years? My father says the U.S. government is casting aside the foundational law of the land and telling us to just look. This is just getting in the way. We don't need that old law. We know what justice is. I mean, we know who needs to die and who doesn't need to die. We know which groups need to be targeted by the IRS and which ones don't. He says that reasoning paves the way for tyrants. And every tyrant is a special tool of the devil. Even more so after he was cast down. Satan, of course, Revelation 12, Satan's been cast down. And look at how he can use these kinds of instruments, these kinds of tools. Individuals who think this way. Look, we know. We don't need the old Constitution. We know what justice is. You can trust us. If there's some law in the book that gets in the way or that prevents us from following through, look, we'll bypass it. We'll move right around it. That was going on repeatedly for 8 years. And now poor Donald Trump gets into office, and he can't do anything right the way the major media views it. Barack Obama, well, he's winning awards. Just last week, he won the John F. Kennedy Profile in Courage Award. Profile in Courage. This is an award that's given out to those who exhibit the qualities of politically courageous leadership. That's the way the establishment views Barack Obama. That's the way the major media views Barack Obama. When he received that award last week, this was May 8th, I believe. Notice this little joke that Barack Obama gave in the acceptance speech. This is clip 5.
I could not be more grateful to the Profile in Courage Award Committee for this honor. I'm also grateful that, unlike the Nobel Prize Committee, you waited until I was out of office.
little humor there at the start of the speech. And yet, if you remember, back in 2009, as he alludes to there, here was the Nobel Prize Committee awarding him the Peace Prize before he even did anything as president. He was nominated, I think it was in the first month or two of that year, right as his inauguration was happening. And then he received the reward later that year. This is a man who was receiving prestigious awards at the start of his presidency, throughout his presidency, and even after his presidency, after all of the facts are in, after all of the evidence is in. And Donald Trump gets into the White House. He can barely change the drapes before members of the media are calling him out, saying that this is a tipping point. The institutions of America are under assault. This man thinks he's above the law. He's running some kind of a police state. Donald Trump. Where have they been for the past 8 years? You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Fleury's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
2 years ago, the city of Baltimore, there in the United States, went up in flames during widespread rioting and looting following the funeral of Freddie Gray. You remember the story, that black man who died in police custody. And, of course, before the trial, before we could even learn any of the details of what caused the death, the protesting, the violence, the looting began, and you had the mayor at the time of the city of Baltimore saying to the police, well, we need to give them the space they need to destroy. Give them a little bit of space. They're upset. They're angry. That was the thinking. And they did destroy. And then, of course, going back to media coverage, when all six of the officers involved were later found not guilty of any wrongdoing, three of them were acquitted by a black judge, even. And of course, some of the officers in the incident were black as well. But the major media made this out to be a black versus white thing, a race thing. my father said following this tragedy in Baltimore. He said, accusations of police racism are heightening public mistrust of law enforcement and fueling a trend of violent race-related incidents and lawlessness. It says anger among certain high-profile segments of the black population in particular is growing and is boiling over in rioting and violence with increasing frequency in American cities. The anger is growing. Well, that was 2 years ago. And since the police was told to give them a little bit of space, not just with the initial rioting, but really with the investigation and everything that followed, here comes the heavy hand of the government. Here comes the Obama administration. Here comes the Justice Department. Here comes Eric Holder. We've got to fix the problems. We've got to find the systemic racism. I mean, the institution, the law enforcement institution is racist. And so leave it to us, the federal government, to fix all the problems. And since that time, what have we seen in Baltimore? We've seen record levels of murder and violence. And it's getting worse. There was a story in the Washington Post just yesterday about this 26-year-old man, this black man, shot dead outside of his parked car. His car had tinted windows. So the authorities didn't know that there was a little baby in the back seat. And they secured the area. They attended to, you know, the guy that got shot. They rushed him off to the hospital. And then they're busily trying to haul the car that had tinted windows back to the police lot. And so over an hour went by until they finally discovered that there was a 10-month-old baby in the back seat crying like crazy. Well, these kinds of scenes are now becoming routine for the city of Baltimore. The Post says, in portions of Baltimore, the strobe of police cars is as much a part of the landscape as boarded up homes. Look at what's happening to this city, or what has happened just in 2 years. It says, but the pace of the killings this year has been stunning as the city struggles to recover from rioting in 2015. As of Friday, the Post reports, 124 people had been slain, including five on a recent day, making Baltimore's homicide rate one of the highest in the country. It's more than triple Washington's rate and higher than the homicide rates in New Orleans and Chicago, two places that have become national symbols of gun violence. So you have Baltimore taking over the lead as far as gun violence is concerned. Says the homicide rate hit a high in 2015. That's the year of the Freddie Gray incident. It hit a high in 2015, 344 homicides. Then the next year, just to paraphrase some of the stats here, it dipped a little bit to 318 deaths. 344, then 318. This year, it says it's on track to beat both records and surpass all other big U.S. cities. And so Baltimore's about to have had three record years of murder, the highest years ever. This year, 2015, and then 2016 in third place. So far, there have been, as I said, 124 people slain in Baltimore, and we're not even through the month of May. This is a city that has a population of just over 600,000 people. Meanwhile, listen to this. Baltimore's police force has shrunk in the past several years from 2,900 officers in 2000, or rather 2,900 just in the last few years to 2,700. So they're losing police officers. Why ever would they lose police officers? Why are Baltimore policemen leaving the department? It says Washington, D.C. has 3,800 policemen, and the city is about the same size. as Baltimore. So they've got a little more than 1,000 more police officers than Baltimore. You can draw some conclusions. This article doesn't do a very good job of it. All it has to offer is this statement. After Freddie Gray's death, theories circulated about how it contributed to the surge in killings that year. Some people believe that the drugs from looted pharmacies contributed to the violence, or that old turf battles had been rekindled amid the chaos. But 2 years later, if there is a Freddie Gray effect, residents say it may lie in a heightened distrust of police that leads people to avoid reporting crimes and seek their own justice. That's the conclusion that the Washington Post draws from this track record of 2 years. 2 years going after those six policemen, and all six of them found not guilty. And ever since, there's been this explosion of violence. And what are the reasons? Well, some have said this, some have said this, but, you know, now that we're 2 years on from it, I think really the problem is people are afraid of the police. It's still the policemen that are to blame. The police were blamed for Freddie Gray's death, unjustly. And the police are blamed for the problems of Baltimore and the skyrocketing murder rate. There's nothing that the police can do to help the situation. And then we're to wonder why the numbers are dwindling? I think some people at the Washington Post need to open their eyes to the facts and to the evidence, to reality, because the poor city of Baltimore is falling apart. You've got boarded up businesses, as this article brings out, and you've got people lying dead in the street next to their car, in which there's 10-month-old babies in some cases. This is what happens when you give criminals space. It's what happens when you give them space to do their thing, to rob, to loot, to murder. The War on Cops, Heather McDonald's piece, or it's a book, actually. I've used this quote before, but she obviously addresses causes, root causes, unlike the Washington Post, sadly. It says, as a Chicago cop told me several weeks ago when I was out there, he's never seen such hatred directed at officers in his 20 years in policing. He said, this is an almost undoable job now. And again, the lives that are being lost in this crime spike. Baltimore is now at its highest per capita homicide rate in its history. She says, this spike, it's almost overwhelmingly black lives that are ending prematurely. She says, but if this continues, we're going to return to the situation of the 1960s and 70s where people were fleeing cities because lawlessness was out of control. That's what's happening. That's why there's houses and businesses that are boarded up. People are just leaving. People are just getting out of these war zones. And she points out in her book that the media has basically suppressed any knowledge of just how bad it is in these inner cities. Well, they report on the spike in murders in Baltimore. But then what are the conclusions that they draw? 2 years later, the so-called Freddie Gray effect is that people don't trust the police enough to report crimes when they see them happening. And so it's the policeman's fault. And much of that police force, by the way, is African American. But that's not worth reporting either. Just leave that out of the story. It doesn't fit the narrative. The narrative is that it's a white institution, it's racist, and if there are problems that we'll admit are there in the inner city, the problem is with the whites. And so the city continues to go up in flames. Here again, Heather McDonald touches on root causes. She says here, this is a breakdown of the family that is leaving kids without any socialization and any decent role models. They don't have fathers. So to say it's an economic problem, I think, is completely false. And you have lots of Asian immigrants who are at much lower income than many people on welfare, and their children are virtually not involved in crime because there are, or they have, two parents at home, and they are teaching them academic discipline and respect for authority. And so it's different in some of these other communities. Isaiah 1, I won't take the time to just go through some of these prophecies we've quoted before, but read on your own time that first chapter in Isaiah, particularly verse 7, where it talks about our cities being burned. My father in the Ezekiel Watchman, or the End Time Prophet booklet, he says, many policemen only feel secure if they do almost nothing. I mean, you can see why. I mean, it was openly stated, and then they tried to retract it after there was such an outcry. But it was openly stated in 2015, hey, stand down, give them space to destroy. And while it might not be openly stated today, that's the mentality. And the thinking is there even within the minds of the policemen. I'm not going to get involved in this. I'm going to steer clear of this. Who knows what they're going to try to stir up? Who knows how many phones with cameras are pointed at me? And so they fear to act. And that criminal element is taking over portions of cities, inner cities. And my father talks about that prophecy in Isaiah 1, where it says, the whole heart is faint. From the sole of the foot, even to the head, there's no soundness in it, but wounds and bruises and putrefying sores. That's what you see from head to toe. There's a sickness there. There's no government. There's no authority where it should be in those local law enforcement agencies. Meanwhile, as I said in the first segment, you have this massive federal leviathan that's just it's amassing more and more power every day. And if there are abuses to come in the current administration, you can be sure that it's because the groundwork was laid for it in the previous one. Read Isaiah 1, as I say, and my father talks about those prophecies in Isaiah 1 in his Isaiah booklet, and of course the Ezekiel booklet touches on those two critical chapters in early on in Ezekiel, Ezekiel 4 and verses 5. When we come back, we'll conclude the program with just a little bit of coverage on Europe, what's happening in Europe and Germany. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why? If God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Later today at thetrumpet.com, Richard Palmer is going to be producing a short video. At least he told me this a few hours ago. So if he changes his mind, he has no choice now. He's got to kick it out there, Sam. You tell him that. he's going to be looking into this cyber attack that you've maybe read some things about over the last few days, pointing out how even though it's a fairly small and simple attack, he's going to note just how much disruption it's caused, and of course then take you back to some of the things we've said at thetrumpet.com over the years about just how vulnerable the United States is to a massive cyber attack. I mean, just think about when a really supersized attack comes against the United States. These kinds of events are just happening with greater and greater frequency. Well, I want to take you through this important article here from the Financial Times. The piece is titled "The Vision of a Closer Europe is Retreating to the Core." I mean, this is really a pretty amazing story, given what the Bible prophesies and what I'll play some clips for you if we have time here in just a second. What we've been saying over the years. But notice what this Financial Times piece says. Champions of European integration are fond of referring to the EU and sometimes the Eurozone as if these are synonymous with Europe. It says, at the height of the Eurozone sovereign debt and banking crisis, Angela Merkel, Germany's chancellor, affirmed, if the Euro fails, Europe fails. And so people, when they think of all of these unions in Europe, they just think of the whole continent, Europe. If the euro fails, then so does Europe. And of course, there's quite a few nations in Europe that still have their own currency. The UK, of course, here is one of them. In the same way, it says, Emmanuel Macron, France's newly elected president, conflated the Eurozone, EU, and Europe when he gave a thoughtful speech about European integration in January in Berlin. The article says, these points are worth keeping in mind after a week in which Macron mania, I guess. That's what they put on the French president. I don't know how you would pronounce that. Close enough. Encompassing hopes of a new dawn for Europe swept over many EU capitals. Yet insofar as they approach their stated goal of closer union, the states involved, listen to this, the states involved will occupy, in years to come, a political, economic, and legal space different from geographical Europe. So this article's point, its main point here, basically, is the European Union, which is about to be reformatted, it's not going to look like the European continent. It's going to be a smaller core of nations. It says, even the Europe whole and free, of which George H.W. Bush, the former U.S. president, spoke in 1989, appears to be far beyond reach. Much of the explanation lies in the geopolitical shocks that have hit the continent in the past 3 years. I mean, this is all changing just in the last 3 years or so, just in the last few years. Financial Times says Europe is set to shrink. Europe is set to shrink, not in a cultural, but a political sense, to an area whose core is the Carolingian Empire of 1,200 years ago. Well, you might not be familiar with Carolingian, but I think many of you are aware of what empire was there in the heart of Europe 1,200 years ago. I mean, that takes you back to around 800 AD. That takes you back to the Frankish dynasty that reigned in the heart of Europe from 751 to about 987. Its first big emperor was Charlemagne. Well, this article goes through Europe around the edges, talking about the threat that Russia poses, how that Turkey at one point was, you know, doing what it could many years ago, trying to get closer to Europe, but now they're moving in a different direction. It says much of the Balkans, too, risks slipping beyond that area, which the future EU or Eurozone leaders will speak of as Europe, quote unquote. Talks about the division in the Balkans. And it says the other factor shrinking Europe is Brexit. At one stroke, Britain's departure from the EU will deprive the bloc of one of its three largest economies, one of its two most important military powers, and almost 13% of its 510 million people. The other side of the Brexit coin is that Germany and France will gain in weight relative to smaller EU states. So, as a lot of commentators have noted, you take out Britain, you take out a nation of that size and power and strength, and that just gives more weight and authority and power in this union that's downsizing even as we speak. It gives more weight and power and authority to Germany and France. And, as the next article I probably won't have time to get into says, really, Germany, even though France has had a lot of the headlines in the last week because of the election, Germany is the one. Germany is the nation that's going to bring this core Europe together. The American interest piece, as I say, I won't have time to get into it, but the title there says Germany holds the key to Europe's future. Okay, we just got through the French elections, but the important election coming up is in September. But coming back to this this core of Europe, these 10 nations, these 10 kings, let me play a couple of clips for you from my father's program, so maybe we can start with the second one, Sam. This is clip number 4 from a Key of David program my father had. I don't have the date. It's from a few years ago, I think, but it's titled The America-Europe Financial Crisis.
There is truly one of the greatest prophecies in all the Bible being fulfilled before your eyes. For decades, people in Europe have tried to unite the European power politically, and they have not been able to do so. And yet, if you look at Revelation 17, it says there are going to be 10 kings there that are going to be a real superpower, and it's going to become what is called the Holy Roman Empire. And it's also going to be led by a strong man, a strong leader that's going to, well, help sort of hijack that European Union, which is a real power in the world today.
That's just one sampling from something we've been saying for many years. This is another program following Brexit last summer. Britain leaves the EU, my father's Key of David program. Clip 3.
Mr. Armstrong also said that there would be 10 kings that would be united in Europe and that they would be dictated to and domineered by Germany. And that, too, is already happening in Germany financially. And it's expanding into other areas. Also, about 30 years ago, Mr. Armstrong said that he thought what it would take to bring those 10 kings together would be a financial collapse of the Western world. Now, of course, there are 27 countries united together in the European Union today. But it's going to be reduced to 10 kings, so says Bible prophecy, and so prophesied Mr. Armstrong, well, over 60 years ago today. That's a long time. So what he prophesied about Germany is just exploding on the world scene today. Anybody can see it. You are reading about it in your newspapers and watching it, the stories about it on television. It's all happening before your eyes, and it is going to affect the lives of every single one of us in a very severe way.
That's from my father's program last summer, Britain Leaves the EU, talking about the 27 being reduced to 10. And then you look at this this latest Financial Times piece, the vision of a closer Europe is retreating to the core. It's retreating to the core. Let me just conclude with a paragraph from this article. Once again, it says, countries such as Hungary, Poland, and Romania are acutely conscious of this, that the dominance of Germany and France, that is. They fear that any non-Euro member sensitive about its sovereignty and skeptical about EU-wide initiatives on defense and migration may find itself outside a self-chosen group headed by France and Germany. It says, this is why controversy surrounds proposals for a multi-speed Europe to impart a new sense of purpose to the EU. It says here, Jean Monnet, one of the EU's founding fathers, predicted that Europe would be forged in crises. He may yet be proved right, but if so, it will be a smaller Europe than the one most of us see when we look at the map. A smaller Europe than the one most of us see, that core Europe, that core union of 10 kings. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.